I specifically wanted today, and again, this is not, I will be discussing other work. This is not any original work by myself. I'll be going through some of the studies of the Dartmouth Atlas team and also of R.A. Cooper. I don't know if anybody in here is familiar with him. Dartmouth's Atlas team, Wenberg and Associates, have now basically defined, they are the underlying assumption for the ACA when you look at it. And I wanted today to actually poke a sacred cow, because what they say is now sacred relative to what I think is PC. And I wanted today to at least perhaps start a discussion and maybe get some input from people relative to some of the things that are said today, because it'll be said again and I'll be on the road, so you guys can help me out as I go. 30% solution, challenging the underlying assumption of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, and implications for successful healthcare reform. I'd like to start it off with a quote by John F. Kennedy that I really, really like, and I kind of incorporate it in almost all of my presentations now, because I'm a truth seeker. That's what Ron Anderson had said we need to be. He kids me, so since he's a truth seeker, this time he's a truth seeker. And Kennedy said this about 50 years, actually, at the, which is actually very interesting. I recommend you go online and actually hear his speech that he gave at Yale. It's delightful. But one of the best quotes he had during that speech was this. What is needed today is a new, difficult, but essential confrontation with reality. Confrontation with reality. For the enemy of truth is very often not the lie, deliberate, contrived, and dishonest, but the myth, persistent, persuasive, and unrealistic. And I think in many things that we do in going forward, we really, all of us, embrace the myth. We embrace strongly held beliefs. And we try to manipulate information and data to be consistent with those beliefs. And this is a case in part with what I think is presented from Wenberg and Associates. Not that they have not provided good science, but I think part of what we're embracing, again, is an underlying belief. And it's important to investigate that brief and test and substantiate some of the things that are being said as a PC, because there are very important implications to doing that. If that underlying assumption is not correct as we go forward, then we have potential huge consequences. Alternatively, there are alternative hypotheses, alternative assumptions that have been forwarded by Cooper and others. Very interesting assumptions, and it's not completely mutually exclusive to the two camps. But I think it's worth it to us and to others to actually address this alternative hypothesis, because this might actually be the path to true reform. So, overview, I'd like to briefly go over the Dartmouth Atlas. Is everybody familiar with the Dartmouth Atlas and Wenberg and that, the pretty stuff they do? And the evolution of the 30% solution, because it actually, it's very interesting. I want to talk about the selling of the 30% solution, because it's actually a wonderful case study. Again, I will be dealing with these relatively superficially, because they're kind of big topics in itself. But this is a case study of a conversion of a hypothesis of assumption to actual national health care policy. Again, I believe, and if you look at it, this is really the underlying policy for an entire Affordable Care Act. I will present some challenges that others have challenges to the underlying assumptions presented by Weinberg and et al. And Fisher. I will give you an alternative assumption that I think is very provocative, and for which I think that there's significant data information in support of this assumption, and that's called the affluence-poverty nexus. And finally, hopefully talk with people in this room about the implications of ignoring that alternative assumption or accepting the current assumption that we have today. So first, talking about the evolution of the 30% solution. So we go back to the original Dartmouth Atlas of Healthcare, and I think they published that atlas in 1999, and all the pretty pictures, and it's very interesting, demonstrating geographic variation across the nation. It was a study of Medicare fee-for-service spending across 306 hospital referral regions in 1996. These hospital referral regions are actually interesting constructs, and I believe what they are regions based upon a neurosurgical service area and or a cardiovascular service area. So they defined it relative to what would be the catchment area for a neurosurgical service, which is a little bit strange. And so these catchment areas are very, very diverse in terms of some being very small, some over a million and stretching across the state, and some being very, very large and capturing a lot of territory. Again, that's one of the, I think, the methodological challenges in terms of what these hospital referral regions really refer to, what they represent. So in studying these HRRs, 1996, they looked at spending, and again, at end-of-life care, and I'll get back to that, relative to what they called effective care, was the relationship between spending and effective care, the relationship between spending and preference-sensitive care. I guess that's patient-focused care. And spending versus supply-sensitive care. End of life, the way that they, and again, all these constructs are, to me, a little bit convoluted. You might be familiar. End of life really refers to looking at spending in the last 6 to 24 months of a patient who had died, right? So they figure, and we'll talk about it a little bit later, it's like, well, if all the subjects died, then somehow they're all even, which is kind of ridiculous, you know, over 6 to 20. But they wanted to see expenditures for end of life for these patients. And that's what they actually compared. Medicare expenditures, I'm sorry. And what they found was a greater than twofold differences across these different regions. And the differences were not due to differences in price of medical services or differences in average illness or average SES, right? So age, race, supposedly income. And again, these are averages. As an example, as the differences, cost per capita or per enrollee for Miami was $8,414 versus Minneapolis, $3,341. And the primary question would be, why should these differences be so big? You know, what's different? What is actually driving that? And from the early research, they felt that it was primarily supply-sensitive care. It was primarily, they attributed the differences between different areas was driven by physician overuse of supply-sensitive specialty services. So again, it was basically discretionary procedures driven by specialists. Beyond kind of the original work, there were two papers that is a triad that actually kind of defined the seminal work. First one, Implications of Regional Variations in Medicare Spending, Part 1. And in this, they show that, quality of care in these higher spending regions was actually no better on most measures, and in fact was worse on several preventive care measures, right? So even though the costs were higher, it wasn't better. And also they demonstrated that access to care in higher spending regions was also no better or worse. So quality of care was no better, and access to care was no better. Second paper, part two, they demonstrated that Medicare enrollees in higher spending regions receive more care than those in lower spending regions, but do not have better health outcomes or satisfaction with care. So more is being done to these people in the Medicare enrollees in these high-cost regions, but it's no benefit to the patients themselves, right? Again, overuse driven by specialists. Get back to why that's important.
So were the outcomes specific to the procedures you're talking about that account for most of the spending, or are they kind of more general outcomes? Because some of the things like prevention, you know, don't really link to where you say that more spending is occurring.
Yes. The answer is yes. They kind of constructed, again, it was a little bit convoluted, even starting with the HRR, starting with the end-of-life care, so they brought everything together, but nothing, it wasn't direct. Again, and you're dealing with Medicare claims data. So again, trying to take, you know, whatever it is. And that's kind of an important point, because again, you know, their conclusions, Medicare spending varies more than twofold between regions. Again, as we progress, those findings that we talked about, right, become more and more extreme as we progress in terms of what those findings mean, right? Yeah. So again, the variation, the fact that the variation is attributable to physician overuse of supply-sensitive specialty services, again, now I'll get back to strongly held beliefs. I mean, this is something that is very believable, right? You can say, well, you know, there's a reason why, the cardiologist is a reason why he's in Beverly Hills, because he's doing a lot of procedures, and that's what people do. You do more stuff, you get more. So it makes sense. I mean, that's kind of belief. I could believe that, you know, that these specialists, and they're driving it. And the third, that the nation already has enough physicians, because they were saying that, okay, if everybody just did what they were supposed to do instead of this overuse, then, you know, everything would be fine. So why do we need more doctors? In fact, the underneath this was that maybe we have too many doctors. And again, this was a discussion 10 to 20 years ago about an oversupply of doctors, and it shifted. By the way, the same person that's challenging this, this group and some of its conclusions, was the same person that was a lone voice 20 years ago that said there will not be any oversupply. There will be a shortage. And he's been borne out. So it really shifted. And then again, he was a lone voice against everybody, every organized entity known as demand relative to medicine. But again, the feeling is, well, we probably have too many physicians as it is. And then the feeling that as much as 30% of healthcare spending is unnecessary. So where they got that 30% figure was, they said, well, let's look at the low-cost areas, right? And if this other cost is based on overuse, right, and it's discretionary, then why shouldn't everybody be able to operate at this low cost? Why does Miami have to be $8,000 per enrollee? Why can't they function at $3,400 per enrollee like Minnesota? So if the assumption is if everybody just functions like Minnesota, then we can save 30%. And that's reasonable. So, you know, what should be different if we're assuming that its overuse is really the problem. So what are the remedies for these conclusions, right? And this now has become a mantra, right? Again, this isn't the Affordable Care Act. This is what it focuses on, right? mantra is, well, we need fewer specialists and we need more primary care physicians. We've heard that, and again, well, okay, that gets us reading, particularly if you're saying that what's driving this whole thing is these specialists that, you know, doing these extra procedures. We need less fee-for-service and more managed care. Again, fee-for-service being one of those driving forces, you know, volume-dependent. It's about more money. It's like, well, these guys are out of control. We're trying to save the system. We're trying to save money. So really, you know, somebody has to reel them in. So we have to talk about less physician autonomy and more regulation. This regulation is important because, you know, and again, we're starting, and I'll show you some timelines. But we're starting with the original work in 1999 and then the papers that I showed you published in 2002-2003. By the time we get to 2007-2008 and the Affordable Care Act is being put together, that 30% now becomes waste and fraud, right? That 30% is waste and fraud. It's not even, it's gone beyond overuse and gone beyond lack of efficiency, and now the term is waste and fraud. And because the term became waste and fraud, it was much more than regulation. A large portion of Affordable Care Act is really due to efficient accountability. So in fact, that's one of the more scary parts of it. The federal government can basically go into anybody's office and just basically wipe you out. Once they make the accusation, you know, based upon whatever Medicare fraud, you weren't doing it right, basically you're done, which is very scary for most people, whether you were right or wrong. But there's a huge part of it, again, that's based around we need to recover this money because it's this waste and fraud that's out here, right? And then an extra, which I'm not really sure where this got in there, but it's important because it had commercial applications. More direct patient involvement and shared decision making, which I didn't realize that really came from the 30% solution, the component of more shared decision making. I had never realized where that come from, but it came from here. Now, as it turns out later on, and it's not accurate, it's not throwing rocks. This really has, for the Dartmouth Group and Wernberg, this particular component, this last one, last remedy, actually had significant commercial application for them, right, later on. They set up some stuff. So that mantra about, oh, yeah, shared decision making. And again, I'm not saying that they did it for any nefarious reason, but it did. And it's not clear where it came from. What's really interesting, and I'll go through this really quickly, was actually the selling of the 30% solution, to figure out how all of us, I mean, people in this room, everybody has a their own personal research mantra. You know, this is what I think, this is what we do, this is my body of work, this is the way I think things need to be done. What was remarkable about this, again, they went from a very pretty atlas. They had a contract with the federal government to do the Medicare atlas, and it was pretty. It was interesting, but they went from that atlas to actually setting national policy for reform, and how they got there was very interesting. And again, it goes to the first quote that I had about beliefs, and I'll go back to that. But why was it so influential? Because this came at the right time, it was the right timing, and it was specifically the right type of message, right? And this is what was called by Robert Evan a zombie idea, right? Which I still can't get the image. Actually, I was going to get a zombie and go have the image, but I don't see what the connection between this type of idea. But he says a zombie idea is this. A zombie idea is an idea that is very neat and plausible. And as I'll show you later, this is a very neat and plausible idea when you look at it. This is a solution that's very straightforward and simple of a kind of a complex thing, healthcare. So it's an ideas are usually neat and plausible. This is the ideas, in order to be successful on a zombie idea, it has to strongly resonate in the popular imagination. So it has to resonate with people. It has to be, yeah, I get it. I feel that. I did this. Yeah, this makes sense to me, and this is what's really happening. I know that, right? So it has to resonate and actually reinforce strongly held underlying held beliefs. And because these things on top usually drive ideas like that, and again, not to get political, but Republicans do this really well, these first two things, and I'm not, you know, but they really do, right? And so, but when ideas are like this, neatly packaged and people want to embrace, what often happens because of these two characteristics is that these ideas move rapidly forward despite incomplete substantiation. So they move too fast, nobody goes back and says, yeah, it sounds like a good idea, but let's really take a close look at it. It gets too far out there before you do that. So it's done, it's gone. And so people start, they go past the substantiation phase, right? And because of that, even though they sound like good ideas, they have great potential to be dangerously misleading. Because again, just because of their simplicity, right? And so again, this compelling notion that specialists are the cause of excess healthcare spending and that 30% could be readily saved is very powerful because, one, it provided a real easy answer to the complex question of healthcare spending. This whole complex thing, how do we bend the curve, came down to, oh, we just got to control those guys. It's real simple. We just got to control those guys. So now a really complex thing is like, I can do it. The second part was, and again, it offered an avenue for control, especially dominant healthcare system. Because that is true. You know, we're out of kilter. It is specially dominated at many different levels. So, okay, we can do something about that. So that's an added benefit, right? It's a continuation of a belief that has been introduced and reintroduced over and over. Because the last century, people have been complaining about specialists for a long time. But the 30% then was especially compelling, as you'll see, because what the 30% said, it gave us a number. It gave us a very big number. It says, "Oh, I can see the money. All I have to do is do this, and there's a big pot of money. You even told me how much it is. Well, it's 30% of the money we spent, which actually comes out to $600 to $700 billion. That's that 30%. So, and again." The reasoning is very straightforward. If everybody just was as efficient as these guys in Minnesota, and I can't see why you can't treat people. They treat people too. If everybody treated people like the guys in Minnesota or in actually New Hampshire and Lebanon, then we can save all this money. It's real simple. And stop these guys from doing these extra surgeries. Simple, compelling. We got it, right? And it appealed to a broad range of constituencies because it was convenient, it solved a lot of problems. Within medicine, you know, we have primary care specialists, economics, politics, public policy, it's the docs. We got to get the docs under control. That's fine.
Right. Yeah.
So the timeline, the Atlas, the Dartmouth thesis, the three papers I spoke about, shortly thereafter, MedPAC, right, they look at this thesis and say, oh, they bring it to Congress through MedPAC. So it kind of gets exposed when not a lot happens, but they hear about this 30%. Oh, we got to spend 30%. There's like big money we can get. We got to, plan. But they kept going because it's Congress, right? 2005, Paul Krugman, and this is important. He introduces this concept, this compelling concept. He introduces it to the public. You know, all we have to do is treat people like we treat people in Minnesota, and we can get this money. And he does a New York Review of Books. So now it gets into the public sector. Shortly thereafter, and it's going like wildfire through cocktail parties. We got it. We knew it. We knew it was those doctors. And then you get to Shannon Brownlee, who I was on a panel with, actually, New America. And she writes a book, and she puts this thesis and overtreat it, right? And now it's gone from providing just these intense resources and providing these services and getting, no benefit to providing these services and having negative benefit. The fact that, and in one sense, I can see that, but now it's going to, these people are actually hurting you, right? So not only is it not beneficial, but it's worse than that, right? So in over-treated, it's a good book, gets the Economic Book of the Year. And again, and again, there's based upon that, there's stories in the Atlantic, and it's the New York Times. So it's everybody, any intelligent person gets it, right? So now it's PC. And it breaks just when the Obama campaign is breaking. So every Democrat since FDR had tried to do health reform. Every single one. Every single one has tried to do health reform. And he's there, and again, he wants to do health reform. And what falls in his lap is this really neat idea. Right? It's really neat idea. And, you know, Paul Arzog gets it, Congressional Budget Office, who then becomes going to group with Obama. And Paul goes back to Obama and says, guess what? You want to do health reform, I know how to pay for it. We can get $600 billion if we just get these guys in line. They just have to treat people in Miami like they do in Minnesota. It's real simple. Right? Because no added benefit, we can't see him. Okay. Goes to Arzog, then to Tom Daschle. So it just hit at the right time. Very simple idea. You can get it. It's like, okay, and it's straightforward. So this is what. So now it becomes part of the Obama administration. It goes into ACA, and this was driving ACA. Those four things we talked about. That's what's driving all of ACA. Because again, there's some thought, and I think there will be selective shortages. I mean, even though there'll be oversupply in some areas, there will be shortages going forward. But the ACA has nothing to address shortages, physician workforce shortages, at all. And because of that, it can't gear up to do anything for, like, I guess, 10 years. If they want to do something now, it's going to be 10-year lag time. So there's nothing. So again, they believe, no, there's not going to be a shortage. These guys are saying there's going to be a shortage, but there's not going to be a shortage. Okay, so that's how it is. So challenges to the assumptions, right? So let's go. And again, there's loans, because again, what I said to you is PC. Now again, I'm a specialist. I'm an ophthalmologist. So I even saying anything about primary care is supreme, and we do need more primary care. But any attempt to defend specialists or any of that is just, well, that's what you expect me to do, right? So it's really hard to do. It's not PC, right? It's not PC. What I would ask, should ask, as Cooper asked, is let's substantiate, because what's more difficult is, it's not that it's difficult for me or I think anybody else to believe, yeah, people, volume dependent, they're going to do more volume to get more money. But what the stretch is, Is this really the whole healthcare system? Are you telling me that we solved this? Because I don't know a lot of guys. I mean, people against volume dependent, but they're not. Most of them are not crazy. And again, I don't think that they are driving the entire system underground. I just don't. I don't think it's that they control that much money. But anyway, we go back. So again, so one of the things is when they originally looked at it. They couldn't explain all the variation, and they attributed all unexplained variation in their model to practice variation. It just attributed. Well, we can only account for 27%, so everything else must be practice variation, because we've adjusted for, and as we'll see before, it's very difficult to do, and they didn't do it well. We've adjusted for these other things, like income, and race, social demographic, but with these HRRs in particular and quintiles. They didn't adjust very well. They couldn't adjust very well. So it's inherent imprecision in just the measuring of the covariates. And so a lot of what's not explained has nothing to do with practice variation. And there's no measure of practice variation. It's just assumption. It's just anything we can't explain, it's the variation. So that's one thing. And then, and part of the adjustment was adjusting for race and poverty. So one of the things that they showed that, well, race has no impact. Well, that's kind of counter to everything we all ever published, we all know. How can race have no impact? Already, that's just kind of suspicious. But they're saying, oh, no, race has no impact. Again, I think it's misspecification. It's like, you know, you can't capture income. And then you're looking at seniors, right? And income is a really poor proxy for wealth and for past economic circumstance for seniors for a lot of different reasons. First, seniors, you know, you don't, income is kind of leveled out, but limited income has nothing to do with what you had before you hit 65, right? So you got a whole, you know, everybody, because some of them were in uninsured, some of them rich, some whatever. So income doesn't mean anything, and everybody goes to senior housing, so residence doesn't mean anything, because senior housing is kind of distributed almost around. A lot of times senior housing is in poorer communities, and vice versa. So it's really hard to make anything of income with people over 65. It's just the correlation is not really good in terms of what you want to measure. And again, the poor specification of those two things, that SES, because again, they were dealing with the senior population, again, contributes to this unexplained variation. Then it's the use of Medicare as a source of data, right? So because they ranked everything based upon Medicare expenses per enrollee, right? However, and again, this is a contract. They're looking at Medicare. The government wants to know, we want to know how Medicare is being spent. However, Medicare expenditures are not correlated with total spending per capita, right? So what you get when you have Medicare expenditures is not what you're going to get. And again, some things is ranked in the southern states, for instance, look like high Medicare expenditures for some of the southern states, Mississippi and some of the others, right? So these are the, you know, high resource, high utilizers. However, when you looked at total expenditures, you see, well, wait a minute, the total expenditures are really low. So it's being projected as a high utilization state, but the reality is it's a very low utilization state. For instance, Mississippi has the lowest per capita specialist rate in the nation. So again, these are, again, misspecified when you just use Medicare. You really need to look at total spending, but in everything, if you want to do correlation. And then regions and rankings different again significantly from non-Medicare revenues. Again, there's very little correlation between what Medicare does, even though everything's ranked on that, versus everything there. And again, consistently what you would see with the groups that, like Minnesota, whatever, those groups that say, oh, their Medicare utilization resources are relatively low. If you look at the total picture, you'll see, well, this non-Medicare stuff is like pulling the freight, right? There's a lot of others, commercial stuff and everything else. Differential status for Medicare beneficiaries, as I said before, they're very different. You have people that went from employer coverage to Medicare, you have the disabled younger, and you have uninsured Medicaid to Medicare. So it's hard to look at that. These two are more likely, and we'll talk about later, to be in very specific communities, in the poor communities and in the underserved communities versus the other ones. So the beneficiaries don't all look the same, even though the numbers look the same at that time. Again, employing death as an outcome, and this is a focus. They focus only on patients who died so we could be sure that all patients were similarly ill. No, all patients aren't similarly ill before they die. Just because all patients die doesn't mean all patients are similarly before they die. And we all know that. Sometimes there's long, drawn-out end-of-care sessions, and sometimes people die very quickly. So it's like, and what you spend for that changes very much. So, again, that. There's an alternative model, because part of what they looked at by using that focus, by focusing on just the expenditures related to 6 to 24 months, that's in part how they got more is less. If you don't use that method for correlating resources with outcomes, you get a different result. And Ong here and Carol, they got a different result. But what they showed was consistently showed positive relationships between resource use and outcome. You do more, you get more. Now the problem is, what is that incremental gain? But that's very different than saying you do more and you get less. They were saying, no, you do more and you get less. Well, that doesn't make sense, but it's pretty compelling if you want to, stop waste and abuse and all the rest of that stuff. So, okay, yeah. No, but everybody else said, no, this isn't correct. You do more and you get more, and the real issue is, what's your incremental gain? Are you really gaining that much? The other is a quintile model, again, which is problematic. They place people in quintiles based upon average Medicare spending. As I said before, again, you can get anomalous results because what's much more valid is total spending rather than Medicare spending if you want to do relationships. And these HRRs that we talked about, these regional area referral areas, again, they were very strange because, again, neurosurgical referral areas, which I don't understand, that could go out to, you know, I don't know how far neurosurgical service area would go. But these HRRs look very, very different. They contain very, very different things. There's very little homogeneity. The comparisons between them are not easy to do. It's not easy to actually interpret what that means, you know, one HRR versus another, because they're actually so different. Now, there's an alternative assumption for why you see these big variations between even the HRR. And that's the assumption of used by Cooper and Al. He says, and when you do any geographic analysis, again, the unit of analysis is very, very important. So he says, as others says, these HRRs are very unusual and we don't know what it really means. So he did analysis, they did analysis at two different levels, which is more knowledge. Did analysis at a state level, and later did analysis at a zip code level, which is still not optimal, but it's better. Probably MSSA is a better level. But when analyses are done at the state level, and when you look at total spending, you get something, again, that makes sense. You get, well, if you spend more resources, you get more. More equals more. More does not equal less. So more total spending, if you look at states, correlates better with access to care. You get better quality of care, better attainment of process benchmarks. Again, the issue is the incremental gain. How much more do you get? Is really, you know, worth it. There's a strong relationship between per capita income, healthcare spending, size of healthcare labor force, per capita physician. That's important because more wealthier states have more infrastructure. And that impacts, as you see, some of the social determinants. So wealthier states display other measures of economic advantage, lower poverty, less uninsured, larger investments in public services. So more is more in several different ways. And again, all of this makes sense. Why would you get more is less, right? And the other analysis. Well, you get more or less, again, if you confine state analysis to just Medicare expenditures because it produces misleading results. In particular, many of the southern states displayed high per capita Medicare expenditures, but total expenditures were very low because they were not wealthy states. And the use of per capita Medicare expenditures set of total expenditures for these states provide anomalous results and a reverse relationship. Again, for some of these states, high expenditures, it looked like high expenditures, had poor outcomes. It wasn't the relationship that you saw with the others. When you look at the zip code level, again, that was a monotonic relationship. You know, again, more is more. When you look at the zip code level, and again, that's looking more at the community level and more at the individuals, you get a different relationship. And you get different information. For one of the things that you see consistently, you see a steep inverse relationship between household income and hospital utilization. Okay? So the poor actually use more resources, and again, it's manifested in high rates of readmission and ambulatory sensitive conditions, admissions for that, and increased length of stay in hospital. Again, and this is inverse to household income. The poorer you are, the more likely you are to be utilizing resources. The relationship is most easily seen and strongest among working age adults, again, for the reasons. Income is a good proxy for personal wealth, and residence, wherever you live, reflects past economic circumstance, and zip code actually captures that. This relationship is supported by MEPS data and is consistent with a host of studies, again, that you see, and mortality studies and other studies, inverse relationship between income and poor outcomes and more utilization. And it's demonstrated consistently that between 50 to 100% increased utilization in the lowest income group compared to highest income group in studies both in the U.S. and other developed countries. Okay, inverse relationship. Remember the original relationship we talked about, there is no relationship between income and others, right? There is no relationship between race. The relationship between race and some of these outcomes is in part based upon residential segregation. So I'll talk a little bit about in the next slide. But now if you look at the seniors, the group that they looked at, again, there's a much weaker relationship. It's difficult to see this relationship because it's difficult to understand what does household income mean for those that are retired and for those that are in Medicare. So it's hard to see that relationship where, you know, what's driving. So this hypothesis is that, well, the poor communities, it's really what's driving this excess utilization and this excess cost, resource cost. And to look at how that impacted the work that Dartmouth did, Cooper took some of the high utilizing HRRs and he disaggregated it into zip code, right? So he can say, well, because this is too heterogeneous, in order to identify the influence of poverty and urbanization or residential segregation on this geographic variation, to see what if he could now correlate this with some of the things that they found and make sense out of it. And consistently, even with, because he actually looked at Los Angeles, because that was a high utilizing area, and he looked at Milwaukee, Wisconsin, because within the Midwest, that was a high utilizing area. And so what he found was utilization rates were three times higher again in these areas, three times higher in the poor zip code deciles compared to wealthiest deciles, right? And what really differentiated these high utilizing areas, whether it's Los Angeles or Milwaukee, from the other areas in the state, was the fact that these areas had poverty cores. These urban areas had poverty cores. They had a much greater proportion and an increased density of low-income zip codes. So when you compare wealthy zip codes to wealthy zip codes for the different areas, amazingly, and it's kind of surprising, you didn't get that much of a difference. Because, and you would think that if what's really happening, what's really driving things is overutilization, right? That's where the action would be. That's where the money's at. That's where the specialists are gonna get their money. Yes.
I just want to clarify, when you say high utilization here, is that in terms of dollars, like in the inpatient care or overall?
Yes, inpatient care. As you know, hospital admissions and
yeah
those types of things.
Sure.
Yeah. And again, you can construct a story why the poor people do that, but this is a consistent relationship the three times and stuff. So again, so when you these high utilizing areas, it wasn't just because they were in cities or other, they were because these poverty cores was really driving this excess utilization. And again, there's little variation between the high income zip codes significant variation in the low income zip codes, even comparison between the two. Because again, part of this was based upon the density of the poverty, right? And how concentrated it was. Because that's why specific areas, the large urban areas, were more likely to manifest this. If the poverty was more distributed, it wasn't as strong. So zip code analysis was statistically strong and demonstrated greater impact, again, for working age adults versus seniors, because, again, it's difficult to see the relationship between income and other characteristics for seniors and retired. If you did what they did for Dartmouth, and you said, well, let's look at the best utilizers, which would be the high-end zip codes, and let's see if the other zip codes function in the same manner as the low utilizers, what would we save? And remarkably, it comes out very similar. You find out that, you know, you'd save, you know, have 35% less utilization among working age adults, 20% less among seniors, and about 30% less overall. So you kind of get to the same place, right? But what you do to get there is very, very, very different. So again, you go back to, and it's consistent with what you see with Weinberg. Based on these analyses, total healthcare spending utilization would be expected to be highest in urban centers with dense poverty ghettos, such as New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, and Los Angeles. Because if you think about it, why should Los Angeles have much higher utilization than the Sacro, whatever area up there? I mean, yeah, there's nothing more elite than up there. UCSF, Academic, Davis, all of that whole corridor, right? So you say, well, but the difference is the density and concentration of poverty. That's the difference. It's not the type of people, it's not what they do. That's the difference. And so you get it in those types of communities. Total health care spending would be lowest in smaller communities where poverty is less frequent and less concentrated. And that describes Rochester, Minnesota, Lebanon, New Hampshire, these nice little communities. There's no real poverty. There's poor people, but no dense thing. And it's consistent. That's what it is. So much of the explained variation observed in the Dartmouth group analysis reflect inability to adequately measure the contribution of low income to healthcare utilization in the Medicare population in specific. And even at the zip code level, and especially at the level of HRR. So there's no way, the way that they did analysis, that they would capture this and they would see this. So they're actually seeing something else. So what are the implications, right? So we go back to, and this is the end, we go back to what happens when we have this zombie idea, right, that's just taken off. And it really took over the ACA. And what are the implications? And it sounds like a reasonable idea, but everything is based upon that. And so since we shot our wad for that, if that doesn't work, health reform doesn't work. Right. And also, you know, if we don't apply strategies to maybe the real drivers, then we'll never get health reform. So the 30% solution provides underlying assumptive basis for the current national policy related to health care reform. Currently appears that even if assumptions related to the root cause of geographic variation is consistent with what was said, the Dartmouth group is saying already, well, we think we kind of overestimated. We said 30%. We think, well, maybe it's about 16%. So we've kind of lost half of that money. So 300, but we got to figure out how to make it up because we got to pay for ACA. We can't pay for it that way. We're saying, well, yeah, we kind of exaggerate a little bit, right? And we can't do what we said. Minnesota can't act like Miami can't act like Minnesota. So we got things. And all those these assumptions are consistent with strongly held beliefs and resonate across most constituencies. And again, it's now PC. As I showed you, there's several methodological challenges that raise questions relative to the validity of it. And again, we went too fast and too far before people were ready to give it the real test, to substantiate it, because it sounded too good. And nobody wanted to go against the wave, go against the grain. But they're real questions, methodological issues. If we blindly continue down this current reform path, without any clear validation that what we're doing is right and it's going to get us to where we want to go, and it might be that, again, it's not mutually exclusive, I'm sure some of the things that are in the current assumptions are true. I mean, I believe that. But is the impact as large as what was presented? I don't think so. And we would waste resources trying to do things again. But this whole bureaucracy now that's there based upon fraud and waste, right, a new IRS-type component, they're not going to get that money out. They're going to squeeze and squeeze and squeeze. It's never going to go out. We're going to just waste a lot of money, right? I think, right? And it'll exacerbate issues that reform is meant to address. Again, if you're under the assumption that, oh, we don't need any more doctors, you know, we have too many doctors, then if we do need doctors, for certain, and I think we do need doctors, not everybody, we do need doctors, then, you know, you've kind of limited what you can do, and you'll exacerbate access issues. This alternative hypothesis resists, and I think that there's pretty compelling evidence that this might have something to do with the root causes of the geographic variation. This this affluence-poverty nexus. And this hypothesis would indicate a very different focus and a very different set of strategies to be successful. There's strategies that we're not looking at, the strategies that no resources are now being applied to, the strategies that are not consistent with the current ACA. And again, ignoring the possibility of an alternative root cause for this geographic variation could undermine our ability to actually enact reform. Again, I go back to the enemy of truth, and I go back to the fact that I think now's the time. Again, I'm a big supporter of the ACA. I'm supportive of many of the current hypotheses and beliefs that had come out of the Dartmouth work, but now's the time to actually substantiate those things and validate them, and again, seek real truth as we go forward rather than depend on what is a myth. So finally, there's clear indication that poverty might be a major determinant of geographic variation in healthcare resource expenditure. Now, that is absolutely problematic. Absolutely. And none of us really wanted to hear that. Because, again, as you know, it's like we're all hungry. Elimination of poverty is not considered a politically or financially viable solution for health equity or healthcare reform. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. Even if we have all the resources. So what can we do? What we can do, though, if we believe that, and if that is a root cause, and I think we need to do more studies to see whether or not it is, to establish whether or not it is, at that point, rather than saying we're going to solve poverty, you know, I think we're compelled to identify those mediating factors, right, by which poverty acts. Right, there's specific factors by which poverty acts. And some of those factors, I think, we can intervene on. Not all of them. But there's probably a set of factors that we can change this, so we can change that, so that we can actually address resource utilization. So again, if we choose to address reality rather than rely on the comfort of myths, again, when we do things that are not easy or not popular, that's usually when we embrace the myths and strongly held beliefs, I think that will be to our detriment. So, again, I raise it. That's it.
Can I follow up then on the last thing you're just saying? Because as you were talking, I thought you were going to say that one of the reasons the expense is higher for poverty areas is because they don't have access to primary care, and therefore they end up in the hospital and more expensive care, right? That would be a common argument.
Yeah, but that's not the whole argument.
Well, yeah, but I want to see what you say about it. So one thing, by increasing access to primary care, you could help, hopefully, with reducing overall cost, if that's really what's happening. But I'm not sure what... I wanted to hear more about what you're thinking.
So again, he went back to, and again, that's what he'll do, he went back to poverty corridors, right? And he went back to... So the setting is really important, and the density is really important. And why is it important? So one, if you talk to any of my friends at the FQHCs and everything else, or you talk to Roberto, but you talk to them, they're not saying what's wrong with those areas is not primary care, it's specialty care. It's impossible for them to get specialty care. So they're putting Band-Aids on, and they're recycling patients over and over and over again. So they're doing the primary part, and there's no handoff. Right, and there's no way to pay for specialty care. Mm-hmm. The federal government through FQHCs have figured out how to pay for primary care. Nobody's figured out how to pay for specialty care. So it's stuck. But if you go back to the mantra, whenever you say more specialists, everybody, oh, you're going to get hooted down. But really, it's really more specialists in very specific areas. Right, which is one of the things. So that's one. But the other part of it is, it's more than that. Because, again, when you deal with a patient... And I go back to the experiment in Massachusetts. Another strongly held belief for most of the people here, they'll say, well, one of the things that we can do is we can give them better doctors, because that's one of the things that people would say, particularly here, right? Well, they need better doctors. Now, and I would say that may or may not be true. I don't know. I know clearly that people here will have better credentials than you would have in those communities. Whether that translates to better care, I don't know. I'm not saying it does or doesn't. I just don't know. So it's something to look at. From a liberal perspective, where if I ask Martin wouldn't want to do it because he wouldn't want to, you know. But I said, that's something we need to do if that's really part of it, right? But I tell you, I had done a study previously when I looked at least what doctors are supposed to do. I had looked in the county system, and it surprised me also for like diabetic care. And I looked at what is the rate by which doctors actually referred patients for their eye checkup, for the yearly eye checkup. As it turned out, and again, it was chart review and everything else, they were actually within that system in the FQHCs and in the county system, they were referring patients at least national rate, in some places much higher. Now, when you went back to look at what actually happened to the patients, whoa, it was a drop off like Niagara Falls. Mm-hmm. So they were doing what they were supposed to do, but you know the setting conspired against them. That patient wasn't going anywhere, and so part of the poverty thing is what we forget about. Is when we go into a room and we see a doctor, we bring a lot in that room with us. We bring a whole support system out there. We bring self-efficacy. You know, if you tell me I have to eat better, I need to rip, you need to eat salads, you need to do whatever you tell me, I have the capacity to do that, right? In these communities, you can ask somebody to do it. They don't have the capacity to do it. They don't have support to do it. So it's all these other things that go way beyond that we take for granted for us and other communities, either personal infrastructure or infrastructure for the community that's not there. So the issue is, how do you make up for that? And that's why I think that's why it's so important that it's poverty. It's not just low income. It's really where you live and all the support stuff. But again, if you disaggregate all those things, you figure out, well, which one of those things can really help. If we intervene by having social support out there, is this something that can mediate that? If we, you know, it's something. I think it's some fixes that we can do that can actually address part of the poverty effect. But you got to go there. And what I was going to say, I'm bouncing back and forth. If you look at and to understand how powerful this is. There's a study done at Man's Greatest Hospital, Mass General Hospital, right? And they have, you know, since they're further along in the experiment, they have a whole system that's out in the community. So they have system of care that's in multiple communities, right? What they've demonstrated that is when you have the same doctors and the same system of care, right, and you put them in these underserved communities, right? It is difficult for them to hit the same benchmarks. Same people, same system, right? So that's the best experiment you can do. They can't hit the same benchmarks. So it's really dependent upon who you're seeing and the setting that you're seeing it. So it's not just these doctors, but it's really much more difficult to see the patients in that setting and given what their issues are, right? Side by side. So again, but I think, again, we have to start to honestly address that rather than, you know. Yeah. So, thank you. I hope there's some troublemakers in this room. I know Ron is. I know he is. But I had some people to shake some trees and say, and, you know, to say, well, maybe we should do this differently. I know he's a troublemaker.
What do you think about the new models of care that they're trying to support, where it's more team-based, where maybe there's case management or navigation or things of that nature to help with the engagement and the
all those
crew?
But how, you know, and in fact, it's I have to moderate something tonight about ACA. If you look at those communities, particularly the private providers, whatever, because you have medical groups that are actually functioning in those communities. Some of them functioning very well, right? On paper thin margins and whatever they're doing. What they need, though, to function really efficiently, they need infrastructure, right? Just infrastructure. It's you know, administrative infrastructure, financial. They need infrastructure, and usually you can't get. The only people who have access to capital in those communities are hospitals. Hospitals always have access. This right here, right? Yeah. You have infrastructure. that would make a big difference. So you can task them to do all of these things, but if they don't have the infrastructure, that's why they can't do what Kaiser does,
right.
And that's why they can't do what Healthcare Partners
does.
These
little independent.
Right, but and even the groups, but because even the groups, even though you have the doctors there, there's still that other stuff that Kaiser gives you or that Healthcare Partners gets you that they don't have because it requires
the data systems.
That's right.
You got somebody
investment.
Crunching and managing.
That's right. That's right. You got somebody managing, even somebody that is full time managing, crunching data, doing analysis. You got some of the stuff in between. The navigators, even somebody that's there's just millions of examples of stuff that's just kind of missed.
Yeah, but they don't have just that economies of scale.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. That's right. In fact, even the FQHCs are going to probably have to do business differently. I mean, you see some FQHCs that now coalesce with others, or you see super FQHCs. So you see like Ultimate, which I consider a corporate FQHC.